call this meeting of the House Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. We do have a quorum. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from March 10th?
So moved.
Representative Akam moves the minutes of March 10th. Any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. And Chair Purcell, first up we have House File 4254. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. Yes, I'd like to move House File 4254 to be referred to Environment and Natural Resource Finance.
All right, Chair Purcell, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is we all hear about simple bills. Well, this is intended to be a simple bill. Some days that's harder to discern than others. But this would establish a DNR project program to come up with recommendations for watercraft operator safety program for boats 16 feet and larger in length. And the intent is to develop best practices to reduce conflicts with other water users and reduce ecological impacts to the aquatic ecosystem and the terrestrial ecosystem, lake shores, et cetera, and to prevent the spread of invasive species. So with that said, we've got, I'm not going to walk through the bill unless anybody wants to, but I'm going to have some DNR folks that are going to assist me in talking about this bill and the outcomes that we're looking for with the watercraft operator safety program for watercraft operation. So that's overview, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Forrester, if you want to state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. Thank you for having me here, and thank you to Representative Purcell for carrying this bill forward. You know, one of the things, we have members all across the state, and one of the things that I'm hearing is that boating is changing in Minnesota. The boats are bigger and faster and more complex, and they have more impacts on lakes and other users. Minnesota has the most boats per capita of any state in the union. So we're kind of a boating state. The problems that I'm seeing revolve around public safety, user conflicts, and ecological impacts. There's a focus in this bill on wakeboard boats, which are very powerful boats that make large wakes for people to surf on behind. The problem is the thrust with the boats can, you know, extend down into the water and churn up the bottom or impact aquatic habitat, silt in spawning beds. The wakes can damage shoreline property. There's been some reported injuries and, you know, wash away shoreline. The other impact with this that we've been talking about a lot lately is aquatic invasive species. A couple years ago, Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center did a study into the impacts or the capacity of different boats to carry aquatic invasive species, and more specifically where on the boats AIS was most likely to be transported. Adam Dahl from the DNR worked on that study and came out with a paper on it. I'd like to share a few things with you about this.
Mr. Forster, I'll just remind you, we have a very full agenda,
okay.
So if you stick to the point, we will
okay.
all appreciate that.
What they found basically was the ballast water tanks on wakeboard boats are the highest likelihood of carrying zebra mussel veligers. The veligers survive longer in the ballast tanks than in other areas. Most people don't understand it. And it isn't well understood how to deal with the problem because it's hard to, you can't get all the water out usually. So I'll share one story quickly. I have a woman that I know, a friend of ours, their family, worked on the Asian carp issue extensively, so no stranger to aquatic invasive species. Saw her at a birthday party, and she asked me what am I working on, and I said, oh, well, it seems like there's some issues around wakeboard boats, and she said, what are they? And I said, well, zebra mussel veligers, transporting AIS, and she said, what do you mean? And I explained it to her, and she got this sick look on her face and said, oh, my God, we keep our boat year-round in Minnetonka, and we have a summer home up on Gull Lake, and we pick the boat up and drop it in Gull Lake. Could we have been the ones that infested that lake? So to me, this points up the need for education. I think all of these problems deal with education. So this bill does two things. First, it asks the University of Minnesota and the Fluid Dynamics Lab at St. Anthony Falls to investigate the impacts of the boat motor thrusts and the wake action of these boats, and then ask the DNR to convene interested parties to look at best management practices based on the best science. That seems to be the key issue. When I looked on the industry website, there's a great quote in there that really hits home for me. It says, the boats aren't the problem, it's the operators. And this really, you know, if people are educated, I think that they will do the right thing and shift their ethic, and we'll have a different, we'll have fewer problems on the lakes.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Jill Sims. And if you've signed up ahead of time, if you can be ready to go when we're taking testimony, we'd appreciate it. Ms. Sims, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Jill Sims, and I represent the National Marine Manufacturers Association. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to provide feedback on HF 4254. As a leading recreational boating trade association, the National National Marine Manufacturers Association represents over 1,300 members nationwide and many brands that you know here in Minnesota, like Alumacraft, Lund, and Premier Pontoons. It is no surprise that the land of 10,000 lakes is number two for watercraft registration, with over 825,000 registered watercraft, or one boat for every six people. We fully support boater education, as boating safety is a critical component of enjoying our state's precious water resources. However, this bill raises several concerns for the recreational boating industry. Number one, this bill does not address boater education for all operators. As written, this language is focused on watercraft only over 16 feet and enhanced wake watercraft, which is not a defined term within statute or within the marine industry. While it has been made clear in the press that this bill is directed towards wake boats, this is a misguided and convoluted effort. To put things in perspective, last year there were 5,200 boats under 23 feet sold, compared to 550 wake boats or wake surfing boats. In fact, of the 825,000 registered watercraft in Minnesota, it is estimated that wake boats make up less than 1% of total registrations. It's also important to note that Minnesota DNR statistics show that non-fatal boating accidents have increased since 2010, and we believe that mandatory boater safety for all boaters is an effective way to help address this increase. Second, aquatic invasive species education is important and should be applied equally to all operators. While we support further and more aggressive AIS education, we strongly recommend that it's provided to all. Realistically, wake surfing boats are less likely to be towed from lake to lake due to their heavy nature compared to a light fishing boat. For example, a bass boat, which weighs around 2,000 pounds, can easily be towed from lake to lake with a typical family crossover. Third, consistent. We encourage boating safety operator education and requirements to be consistent with other recreational products. Additionally, we recommend the inclusion of the National Association of Boating Law Administrators, NASBLA, in the process. NASBLA is the leading nonprofit for recreational boating safety and offers course design and approval for states offering boater safety programs. States that require these safety programs typically offer a NASBLA approved or designed course for their operators. It's important for users and safety purposes that we keep these standards consistent. Finally, we think it's important that the DNR leads or manages any studies, as they are the department focused on managing and protecting our water resources in Minnesota. This provides a neutral forum for inquiries and public input. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to express our concerns with this bill and look forward to working with stakeholders to establish a boater safety program that educates all boaters on best practices to enjoy the land of 10,000 lakes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Colonel Smith, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair, members, we'd like to thank Representative Chair Purcell for bringing this forward. Like Mr. Forrester did say, boating has changed in the state. We do have a watercraft operator safety program that has been in place for several decades. It's the only recreational vehicle or watercraft type safety education program that doesn't have a born-on date or mandatory. So for ATV, snowmobile, firearm safety, for example, if you're born after a certain date, you're required to have some type of safety education program. We're very interested in exploring that possibility in the future. We have some concerns with singling out a potentially individual watercraft type. I think this is a good opportunity, and the department thinks it's a good opportunity to get interested parties from both sides of the issue at the table and talk about some solutions and some issues in the interim, and maybe come up with some things that we can bring forward next year that would be some type of compromise and really move things forward. We've been through this in a few years ago or a couple decades ago with personal watercraft when we had some issues with personal watercraft. Obviously, they're not the same, but the root is that you have a user conflict, and it's on the water. And so I think the department and the legislature and interested parties back then worked really well together to find some common sense laws, but we also did a lot of education and outreach with those people that are operating those types of machines. And I think we've gotten to a place now in the state where we don't have that user conflict in personal watercraft. I think we can mirror that process with this and really look forward to getting those folks together at the table and coming up with a good solution for next year.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to discussion. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a question for Colonel Smith. There's quite a bit of discussion in the bill about invasive species, but I'm wondering about, with the power of these boats and shallow lake bottoms, and if we have a lake that has contaminants in the sediment that are currently contained in that sediment, and then you have a higher powered motor that stirs up the lake bottom and suspends those contaminants in the water, have you guys seen any evidence of that or anything in terms of aquatic vegetation destruction? Or I'm concerned about that particular component, because we may have some lakes that have a greater amount of contaminants that are currently contained in the sediment.
Colonel Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. So there has been some research out there, and I don't know if it's been peer reviewed, and that's one of the reasons we'd also like to take some time in the interim to have the DNR make their decisions based on the best science available and something that has been peer reviewed. And so that's definitely a concern. We have talked with our fisheries folks and ecological and water resources folks, and you know, they're just starting to get their arms around this. And so this will give us an opportunity to look for that best science if we have to do it on our own, but and consider those issues, because it is a concern for the department.
All right, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Smith and Chair Purcell, is it safe to say that this bill is a work in progress and education is the best tool we have to combat these issues?
Chair Purcell.
Representative Heintzman, yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any members, any further discussion? With that, Chair Purcell, any closing comments?
Just appreciate the conversation, and we'll look forward to making this happen here.
All right. Chair Purcell renews his motion that House File 4254 be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Let's see. Next up on the agenda, Chair Purcell, you're not going anywhere. House File 4058, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move House File 4058, recommend pass and move to Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
All right, and I see there's an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment to put the bill in the form you would like?
Madam Chair, thank you. I move the A2 amendment.
Actually, I'm taking a look at this. It actually, double-checking with research, but it looks like it's the A20-0699 amendment. A20-0699. All right. Got to get those numbers right. All right. Any discussion to the A20-0699 amendment? All right. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Motion carries. Representative Purcell, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the MPCA policy bill, and there are a number of measures that MPCA is advancing here, and I have with me Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka to walk us through the bill.
All right, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And as our author mentioned, there are three provisions in here, all in the lands area, which is the area I work in. And so I'll work off the delete all amendment and go through them in order. And here, and I know you don't have much time, so I'll go over it in a quick fashion here. Section one and the last section of the bill are related. Right now in rule, it states as we list Superfund sites, we have to use the federal scoring system that was put in place in 1990. EPA updated that in 2018, and the big reason is the inclusion of soil vapor and vapor intrusion being added into the scoring. So now when the state and federal government scores a site that's looking to be listed on both, we have two different scores. All we're asking to do in the put in statute is that we use the most up-to-date EPA scoring system, and then repeal the rule that has the old one that has a specific site so that we don't have to come back in the future. We just do this once, and as that information keeps getting updated, we use the most reliant. The next provisions really span three sections, and that's section 2, 3, and 4 of the bill. And this deals with our closed landfill program and specifically priority qualified facilities that are in that program. Just a quick history here, a background that's helpful on what the closed landfill program is. It was enacted in 1994 as an alternative to Superfund to address old landfills and ensure that they were being cleaned up. Prior to that, the Superfund program had a lot of legal and administrative actions moving forward, but little cleanup. And this was a way to move forward and address those sites. Part of that legislation created an agreement, a deal between the states and the landfill owner. The state would take care of the property, do the cleanup needed, any construction, and take care of it into perpetuity. On the other hand, the landfill owner needed to provide its insurance records to the state, which the state did successfully do some cost recovery against insurance companies, and then to allow the state to do the required remedial and cleanup work. Fortunately, 109, this worked very well. Our 110th, when we started going into this, it did not work well, and it broke down. And in 2017, the legislature created another category, which is the priority qualified facilities. For those uncooperative landfill owners that were not keeping up their part of the deal, it gave the state ability to actually do the work and then seek back cost recovery or other types of actions to make sure that human health and the environment were protected. And so as the agency started looking through that and applying that to its first landfill, we noticed there were a couple things that could be improved. And the bill really here does two things. It would benefit the state and the landfill owners. The first, it protects the state and the state's taxpayers by allowing it to better recover expenses from uncooperative landfill owners, and also prevents the uncooperative landfill owner from receiving an unjust financial windfall. The second is, it also protects the landfill owner from any double liability. It ensures that the state acquires the property in a fair manner if it uses the condemnation process. And so I'm just going to quickly highlight the three problems that were identified and that we're solving through this bill. The first is, if the state were to move forward and use condemnation as a way to gain access and be able to do the cleanup, that it would do it in a way that is protective of the state's investments and also not require the state to go through a condemnation process, have the state make a payment, and have that person get a financial windfall, the uncooperative landfill owner. And the problem occurs in just how the process is set up. The condemnation starts off first, and what happens is at that point the appraisal is done and the state would then acquire the property and give over dollars for the compensation for getting the property. The cleanup would occur, and then because of the 2017 language then, the state would then come back and seek back the cost recovery for the cleanup. But in between that time, that money could be spent or put in places where the state could not get and reach it, and when it comes back to actually collect it. So the state would be giving a windfall out, and then when it would come back and try to collect its cost, that even the money that the state had put there that we know that the former owner had is gone. And so what we're doing in this legislation, and it is section four of the bill, is what we're saying is, let's do that all at once. We do the condemnation at the same time. We look at what the cost and the compensation for the property owner is, and at the same time, find out what the cost of the remediation is. We look and see if there's a difference there. If the cost of the cleanup is less, or remediation is less than the worth of the property, the state then provides dollars for compensation to that landowner. If it isn't, then the state moves forward and acquire the property. This fixes that problem where there isn't an unjust windfall or that the state taxpayers' investment is not protected. In doing so, we also put provisions in here to protect the landowner. One, and there has been court cases on this, where the concern is that the state or public entity would purchase the land, ask for a very low price, saying it's contaminated or needs a lot of work, and then later another agency or that same entity would come back later seeking cost recovery for the cleanup. So someone is getting double hit. What we've done in here explicitly state is the state would have to use the property value of the cleaned up value if it is to come and ask for the cleanup value. So the landowner is being treated fairly, and so that they're only getting to be asked to do the thing once, not twice. And so we've set that up in a way here through the process so that it is fair for the landfill owner and also the state. A related fix to that too is that after the condemnation process is completed, allowing if the state has to surplus the land, the state would not sell it back to the property owner for the cost of what it was. So for instance, if the cleanup costs were more than the property's worth, the person would get the land back for a nominal fee, about $500. This would undo everything else that the legislature has put in place in the 2017 legislation and treat them like they were a cooperative landowner. And so we also make that change, that loophole. The second problem we had is if the state actually went onto the property, didn't need to or didn't acquire the property, the state would do the work, put a lien on the property to recover its cleanup costs. There are ways that the state could never actually collect on that lien. And one of that is if someone were to use the property to earn an income. For instance, if they just rented it out to store some old vehicles on it. That would be enough to prevent the state and the taxpayers from coming back and recollecting its investment. The same with a six-year limit. So basically, the landfill property owner could shortchange the state by just running out the clock. And so we, in Section 3 of the bill, remove those restrictions that are placed on the state to ensure the state can get back its investment. The third thing that this bill does, and is also in that same section, is something we heard loud and clear from the legislature here when we came and talked about one of these facilities in the past. And that was concern of an unjust windfall for a property when the cleanup may be substantial, but that the value increase in the property was more than that. That was, so what we've put in here is a windfall lien, saying that if the property increases in value because of the state's investment in the cleanup, the state then can lien for the increased amount in the value of the property because of the cleanup. That is because of the state and taxpayers' investment, so the state then can collect back that part that it improved the property. So what we do is we find out what the property is worth before the cleanup and afterwards, and that difference is what the state is entitled to through a lien. And so those are the three things that we've fixed in this provision. I just want to make one, two quick caveats just to make sure it's
quick.
Clear, is that even under these actions, it is likely the states will not be able to collect the full amount of the cleanup costs. And just to be clear on that, because the property values in these type of situations will be less than the cleanup pieces. Just want everyone to go in eyes wide open. The second, if a property owner still at this point decides to enter into a binding agreement, becomes a cooperative landfill owner, the state would have to do the cleanup, pay that investment, and the person could then use the property in any way they want afterwards and not have any liens or anything against them. That is just the deal that was for the other 109, and just want to be clear, I know that is something that has been talked about at the legislature, especially when we're talking about some of these cleanups being in the hundreds of millions of dollars on these properties. Just to, so that is clear, because that is what the existing law allows. The last real quick piece then on this bill is Section 5, and this is about environmental covenants. And this is about landfills that have closed, that are not in the closed landfill program. And what this allows for and what the solid waste rules have is that there would be need to be some type of notification on the property deed so that if someone were to purchase the property or they would have to keep up certain types of actions. What this allows is the use of the environmental covenants, and under the Environmental Covenants Act that was passed in 2007, which is after the solid waste regs went into place, it envisioned that environmental covenants would be used for closure, contingency, and corrective actions at disposal facilities. The difference is the Environmental Covenants Act requires us to hook that up to each program. And so in the past, the legislature has allowed this ability to be used for Superfund. A few years ago, we came before the legislature and asked for this authority to be used for petroleum sites, and now we're asking for this tool to be used for the solid waste program. Just to be very clear, an environmental covenant cannot be placed on one of these properties without the property owner's approval, but this does allow for more upfront information when there are property transactions. We have had cases, for instance, south of Austin, where an old demolition landfill was sold to various folks, and they didn't know that there were restrictions, that they couldn't take actions that to disturb the cat. So the farmer wanted to plant soybeans and was not allowed to and didn't know that going in. A notification, which is allowed under solid waste regs, is like a post-it note, easily lost when you're looking through documents. An environmental covenant is something the attorneys are going to see and make sure the property owner knows, and that can later be pointed to make sure those actions are being taken place. This not only happens in rural areas, this happened in urban areas. In Winona, when there was a development of some large box retail stores and they wanted to build on an old disposal site, we also had issues where they were unaware that disturbing the cap and the cover would create problems. And so this is what this law is hopefully, the proposal is to do, is to put in the law ways to protect those situations from occurring in the future, protecting those who have closed the landfill and those who have bought the property. Chair and committee members, thanks for the time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm go to your first point on the Superfund site on lines 1.12 and 13. So the implication of your testimony was that the federal government standards for Superfund sites would always get stronger. And that's hard to believe these days with EPA rolling back rules all over the place. So we could then, with this language, be in the position of having lower standards for Superfund sites.
Mr. Kudelka.
Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. This would have the most up-to-date information and the scoring system that the feds use. Currently, the feds use a scoring system that would have a higher score because it brings in the soil vapors. The scoring system is what is used to get onto the list. The cleanup, the standards that we clean it up to or when things need to be cleaned up are a different set of regulations, not connected to this. This really is the process where we do the listing, we have to score to provide it to the public, the information, and if it scores high enough, it gets on the federal list. The state list doesn't have a threshold. You have to score 28.5 for the feds. The state list, there is not that number. And then we do the cleanup on a different set of regs.
Representative Guineas.
The point is that for scoring, the federal government could roll back. And so lands that should be going on the Superfund list or sites that should be going on the Superfund list wouldn't make it because the federal government has rolled back.
Assistant Commissioner Kudelka.
Chair and committee members, that would be the case for the federal where they have to hit a threshold of 28.5 points. On the state, that would not be the case. There is not that threshold. So we score as a part of the exercise to get it onto the site listing and proposal, but you don't have to hit a score to be listed on there. A very low score could still get you on there because it's a tool to open up tools, authorities, and financing the state can use to work on a cleanup. So as long as there's a scoring system there, it's more, the state is still protected to be able to put on its list when it may not be put on the federal list.
Representative Guineas.
I remain concerned about this particular language.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one real quick question for the bill author. Because this is obviously deals with land titles and other things that aren't normal purview of this committee, do you anticipate after finance this may go to government ops or judiciary? In other words, there are some other areas that look like they're touched.
Representative Lewick, the motion is to move it to judiciary and civil law.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see what I did. Good. That's all I needed.
Chair
Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, the answer is yes.
All right. Chair Purcell, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate the conversation around this bill and just ask for your consideration and approval. Thank you.
All right. Chair Purcell renews his motion that House File 4058 as amended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Chair Purcell, now we've got House File 4286. Would you like to move your bill?
Let me, yes. Madam Chair, I move House File 4286 be approved and move to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
All right. Chair Purcell moves House File 4286 to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Chair Purcell, do you want to go ahead and introduce your bill, or do you want to go straight to Assistant Commissioner Gauthier?
Madam Chair, the Commissioner will walk through the bill, so we cut right to the chase and go to the bill. Thank
All right,
you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Greta Gauthier, Assistant Commissioner, MPCA. Madam Chair, I just have a couple of brief framework or context for the bill, and then I'll walk through it. Madam Chair, members, this bill is the agency's bill that is coming in the wake of two major enforcement actions that we have been heavily involved in the last recent time. What this bill does is it clarifies and makes uniform our existing enforcement tools that are available to the PCA commissioner. All and everything about this bill is intended to better protect Minnesotans and the environment. This bill clarifies, as I said, several enforcement tools that we already have, including reopening permits for permit violators, ordering the facilities of permit violators to cease operations, holding violating permittees accountable for what they agreed to do to remedy their violations, leveling the playing field between those facilities who get the permits that they need and those who do not, and making the availability of enforcement tools uniform across all programs. This bill is needed because Commissioner Bishop and Assistant Commissioner Tester and the agency want to be very clear and transparent to all facilities and all permittees so that everyone knows how they intend to move forward with enforcement in the future. Walking through the bill, Madam Chair, generally this bill is making changes to two statutes, Chapter 115 and Chapter 116. So Chapter 115 is water pollution control, one of our major chapters for our activities. Chapter 116 is our enabling chapter that created the Pollution Control Agency. So first in chapter, we're making changes the same in both of those chapters. So on page 1, line 21, you'll notice that we add the word reopen. That allows the commissioner to, that clarifies that the commissioner has authority to reopen permits in certain circumstances. And then we skip to page 6, Madam Chair, at the top. And this is also under Chapter 115 and remedies available to the commissioner for enforcement purposes, and it includes cease performance, ordering a permittee to cease performance. You'll note the commissioner already has authority to compel performance, and this is clarifying what that means also to also then on subdivision or section 3, line 6.8 stipulates that in her use of an injunction, the commissioner may also require a facility to cease operations and conditions on when they have to be open. I don't know where that is.
And of course, Bill, the our staff person has left the room. If we wanted to find him again.
I'll just for John. In stipulation agreements, this is the section here, section 4, starting on line 6.12, where we are saying that permit violators have to be accountable for what they agree to do in the stipulation agreements or other negotiated settlements designed to remedy their violations. And it makes them accountable to carry out those agreements. Then section 5 is where I had said that we will make uniform authorities. This is where that occurs. Under section 5, the commissioner may bring an enforcement action against a person or a facility that is required to have a permit that fails to obtain a permit. The penalty for failure to obtain a permit under this section is increased for every year the person or the facility failed to obtain the permit. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Moving on to page 7 at 7.15 is where we start making these exact same changes, exact same language in Chapter 116. So Section 7, Section 8, and Section 9 make the same changes we made in Chapter 115. In the interest of time, Madam Chair, I will end my testimony here and be available for comments.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right. table.
Sign him up, Madam Chair.
Yeah. All right, members, any discussion to House File 4286? All right, Chair Purcell, any closing comments?
Just thank you, Madam Chair and members, and appreciate support for the bill.
All right, Chair Purcell renews his motion that House File 4286 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Sandsteed.
I'm done now. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're free. So next up, we have House File 2383. I will move House File 2383 be referred to the Education Policy Committee. This bill did get a full hearing last year, so we're going to try to keep things brief. However, there is an amendment. I will move the A20-0612 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Representative Sandsteed, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. As you stated, this bill was heard last year. It was heard after the deadline, so it was basically an informational hearing. Since that time, or during that hearing, some questions arose. The amendment today is a result of some of the questions that were raised. This is what I'm calling our peace in the valley. House File 2383, as amended, clarifies some technical items regarding the position of the School Trust Lands Director. The position was established in 2012 to provide recommendations to both the executive and legislative branches about the management of the state's school trust lands. After a couple of years of discussions about the appropriate responsibilities of this role, this is the Peace in the Valley solution to make overdue updates. Most significantly, the bill increases transparency by reorganizing the duties regarding the director's advice and recommendations requirements, reporting requirements, and other duties. It requires that they submit an annual budget as well as a plan with legislative recommendations for review to the Permanent School Trust Commission. It provides clarity by requiring the director to act in a fiduciary capacity for school trust land beneficiaries. It provides uniformity and consistency with other executive branch appointees. Finally, the bill provides flexibility by reducing restrictions to the director's ability to hire and retain employees. There are no fiscal implications in the bill. Last year's special session omnibus environment and natural resource bill had a provision from this bill's original version, which modifies a prior appropriation for the school trust lands director to allow the use of money to complete a 25-year framework for managing school trust lands and extending the availability of the funds, which has been set to expire June 30th of last year. And I stand for any questions.
All right, and we'll go to the testifier first, if you can introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony. And I will remind everybody who's waiting and those up for this bill that we do have several more bills to get through today. So if you could keep it brief, we'd all appreciate it. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Aaron Vandalin, Minnesota School Trust Lands Director, and I first appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill again, as we did last year. I don't need to belabor any of the points that Representative Sandsteed made. I do want to express my appreciation to the Permanent School Fund Commission for working on this bill with our office over the last few years. With that, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Members, any discussion of the bill? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Representative Sandsteed, for bringing this forward. this bill has been worked on and for quite some time, actually even before last session. So, you know, it's time to just get this thing moving. We seem to not be able to really get the kind of attention we need on the school trust funds and the huge part that plays in education. So, yeah, let's get this thing out of here and ultimately get it in front of the governor.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Vandalin, and to the author, thank you very much for all the work that we've been doing on this. As Representative Purcell mentioned, this has been going on for a long time. Since I've been here, I believe back to 2011 and 12, we started having conversations about the role of the director and so forth, and this is something that I think is very, very important, and I applaud you for the good work. But I do have one question for Director Vandalin. It says in the bill that it removes the cap of 5 employees. Director Vandalin, do you have any idea where you would go in the near future in terms of an expansion of your workforce?
Director.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, members, currently the school trust office has 2.5 employees, including myself. We're looking to hire 1 additional staff person at this time. I would note in the bill it does limit the ability of the director to hire staff to any available appropriations.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor of House File, I will renew my motion that House File 2383 as amended be referred to Education Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. Next up, we have House File 3867, Representative Moeller. I will move that House File 3867 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. It does look like we do have a DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
No.
Opposed? They're all focusing on their treats. thank you, Representative Moeller. The motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Representative Moeller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to be in front of this committee for the first time. I did bring treats. Representative Claflin got a little grief and just downstairs in Judiciary for not having treats. So if there are any leftovers, I can take those down and share those with members of my committee on her behalf. I just wanted to let you know that this bill is an agency bill, and it has to do with data practices and data privacy. So we will be hearing this in Judiciary Committee. And I just wanted to turn it over to the department, but before I do, thank them for working with the Minnesota Coalition of Government Information. That's what the DE1 amendment does. It really clarifies what kind of data is going to be kept confidential. And I really appreciate the work that the agency did with that coalition, which is going to be very important to us in the Judiciary Committee when the bill gets there. So with that, Madam Chair, if I could turn it over to my testifier, please.
Yep, sounds good. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Robert Carey. I am a staff attorney in the General Counsel's Office for the Department of Natural Resources. Part of my job is to advise the department on the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act and Chapter 13 in the Minnesota statutes. And as the representative has alluded to, I helped craft some of the language of this bill. The bill that you have before you is really aimed at making data on individuals who are minors private data. As a government agency, the DNR maintains government data, and sometimes that government data is on individuals who are under the age of 18. Some examples of this can include hunting and fishing license applications, safety training programs, or information generated from a DNR state-sponsored event, for instance, an event that's held on a state park. DNR feels that it's important that this type of data receive an added layer of protection that it currently doesn't have under Chapter 13 of the Minnesota statutes. The Data Practices Act has a presumption that all government data be made public data unless there is an explicit provision of Chapter 13 saying otherwise. Currently, there is no explicit provision under Chapter 13 that makes minor data on individuals private data. So what we're trying to do here is exactly that, making data that's maintained on individuals who are under the age of 18 private data. As the representative has also mentioned, in working up this bill, we've reached out to the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. That is the impetus for the amendment that you have before you. It represents a accommodation on Minkoji's desire to sort of narrow the scope of this bill and really drill down on those categories that you see in items 1 through 10. So the language before you is a result of those discussions. It's supported by both Minnesota DNR and Minkoji. That sort of wraps up the summary of the bill. I'm happy to make myself available for any questions on any of the details of the bill from the members.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We'll make sure there aren't any other testifiers first. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Nobody's moving, so I'm guessing that's a no. We'll move on to member discussion. Members, any discussion? Representative Lewick.
Two quick questions. One, on line 2.1, we talk about other data. Would that include pictures, for example, that maybe the DNR had acquired at an event of minors involved in some type of DNR event?
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would if that data could identify, if an individual who is a minor is identifiable in those pictures, that would be wrapped up in that category, yes.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Second part of that would then, if it was in, you know, mutual benefit that the minor and the DNR wanted to actually use that for something in a magazine or some type of an educational thing, is there a provision there so that you could get a release from the parents or the minor to actually use that in public or make it non-public, I guess is the way to describe it?
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair, Representative, the classification that's being contemplated by this bill is private data on individuals, which would make the data not public for everybody but the subject of the data. So if the minor would request the subject or request the data themselves, or the minor's guardian would request the data themselves, we would be obligated to turn it over mm-hmm. in that instance.
Representative Lewis.
Yeah, and it might just, and not a concern, but just to make sure we don't tie ourselves up too tight, that if you wanted to use something from the DNR's perspective in a publication or whatever, and you know, making sure you could go through the process, if that was acceptable with the parents and that individual, that obviously if you stuck a picture in there and it had a minor there, that certainly would be release of that they were involved in something. So I just want to make sure we don't unintentionally encumber, make it too hard to do the proper education thing, because kids like to see kids doing things. So otherwise, yeah, this certainly makes all the sense in the world. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We wouldn't want to hold up any No Child Left Inside coverage in the volunteer, for sure. members, any further discussion to the bill? All right. Representative Mueller, any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3867 as amended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Yep, thank you. All right, next up we have House File 3847, Representative Mann. I will move House File 3847 be referred to the Committee on Commerce. There's also an author's amendment. I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mann, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 3847 is a small step in getting us to change the way we shop. This bill does not ban anything. It simply seeks to foster change in behavior so that we as a society can depend less on single-use plastics.
We know that single-use plastics are harmful to the environment. We know that about only 9% of all plastics that we use actually get recycled. Most of it ends up in landfills, floating around in the ocean, or just gets stuck in our natural world. And we use about 100 billion single-use plastic bags per year in the United States. So, out of breath, sorry. So what this bill does is that it charges a small fee of 5 cents on single-use plastic bags. This fee can be increased at the discretion of the retailer. And what's unique about our bill is that that fee stays with the retailer. We just ask that they use a portion of it to provide reusable bags that people can purchase. And the, we also give the retailer the ability to charge a small fee for paper bags if they wish as well. So what it comes down to is that we want people to live with less plastic and change old behaviors, and that is our goal today. We want to reduce waste, and instead of asking people to reduce, reuse, and recycle, we want people to refuse. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We do have a couple of people on the list to testify. Priscilla Villa-Watt. She's here. Looks like maybe not. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? All right, well, we'll move on to discussion. Members, any discussion? Representative Lewick.
To the bill author, does the Attorney General buy into this, and they discuss any potential new costs that the department would end up incurring enforcing this?
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so we, you know, we are making a new a fee for a new violation. The AG has not commented on it. I haven't heard from them at all, but this will likely incur a fee.
Representative Lewitt.
I guess one other quick question. So would somebody complain or file a complaint to the Attorney General, and then how would this be triggered? That we get into this, is it $1,000 a bag fee if they violate?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, no, it's $1,000 per day for a violation. Okay. So it doesn't matter how many bags they didn't charge for that day.
Representative Lewick.
So as I understand this, then if somebody declined to put this in force, every day after this goes into effect, they would be subject to a $1,000 a day fine. Is that how it works?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Lewick.
Well, that seems like that's not exactly carefully convincing people to make a conscious decision. That seems like pretty onerous, particularly they're not all Walmarts and they're not all great big grocery stores. There's lots of little stores out there. So I don't know. I got some real angst over using a sledgehammer, and that's what I think that kind of a everyday penalty is. So anyway, I can't support this with that kind of a sledgehammer approach.
Members, we rarely agree on everything in this room. Representative Heisman may have, and I may have agreed 4 times, but you know, in 4 years. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Mann, you said that it's per day, but can you show me specifically in the bill where the penalty is per day, not per bag?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can certainly make that more clear.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mann, you referred to the bags as single-use bags. They're not single-use bags. They're recyclable, correct?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, they are theoretically recyclable, but they cannot be readily recyclable at your curbside. And again, only less than 10% of them are actually recycled.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I know in my house, every time I, not every time, but when I go to our local Super One grocery store,
I take the plastic bags and I put them in the recycling box. So the idea that these are single-use bags, I think, is obviously inaccurate. So who's going to be the plastic bag police? If Representative Mann would answer a question.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Right now, we have charged the AG's office to be that, but we don't have a specific uniformed force that would be around policing plastic bags.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mann, so, but walk me through this then. How is this actually going to work? Who's going to go out and check on businesses to see if they're complying? Are we going to do surprise checks like they do businesses selling tobacco to minors? What?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative. So this is not, you know, we made the bill as lenient as possible, truthfully, right? We're asking the retailers to keep their fee. We are not having someone go out and inspect stores. A lot of the stores in our state are already charging fees for bags, and so we feel like most people want to do the right thing here. So that's the way it's going to work. We're going to rely on people to do the right thing.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mann, I appreciate that, but you're not asking people to do the right thing. You're telling people what they have to do, correct?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. So we are saying that you should charge a fee for a bag. We are saying that. And then we are also saying, again, that you can keep that fee. The state is not collecting that. We are also not sending police to every store to enforce this.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Representative Mann, here you just said that again. You just said that you should charge for the bag.
Correct.
But the way I read it, you must charge for the bag. Mm-hmm. Which is it?
You must charge for the bag, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
All right, Representative Heintzman. All right, Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is just completely out of line, and I want to ask for a roll call vote because I want to make darn sure my small grocery stores absolutely understand where at least I stand on this unequivocally, because $1,000 a day, I mean, we've got grocery stores that are barely the size of this room, and Attorney General running around become the plastic bag police guy. I just think we're way overstepping what we should be focused on here in St. Paul.
Roll call is noted. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have missed this, but to the bill author, could you please again explain the reason for the amendment?
Representative Mann.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. So the amendment exempts certain populations from this fee, specifically people who are on TANF, WIC, or SNAP.
Representative Anderson.
I would just ask why.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, because again, we wanted to make this as less burdensome on people as possible. We don't want to, you know, charge a dollar per bag and put a financial strain on people. We don't want to put financial strains on people who are already financially strained. And that's also the reason why in the bill we stipulated that retailers can keep that fee, because we're not trying to put a fee on retailers either.
Representative Anderson.
So it will raise the cost of grocery items for everybody but the people on your amendment, correct?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, not if you bring your own bag.
What if you don't bring
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Representative Mann.
Then you can get a plastic bag, or you can purchase a reusable bag and then bring your own bag next time.
But will it increase the cost of food? If I don't bring my own bag, will it increase my cost to buy groceries?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, it depends on how many bags you'll need. It'll be 5 cents per bag.
Representative Anderson.
Will it increase the cost of my groceries at the store?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mann.
Representative, no.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Well, where does the 5 cents come from?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, it comes from anyone wishing to get a bag at the grocery store.
Representative Anderson.
So it's my cost then?
Madam Representative Chair, Mann.
If you get a plastic bag.
So it will
Representative raise my, Anderson.
It will raise my cost of whatever's in that bag then.
No.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. What's in the bag is stays the same cost.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Will my bill be higher when I walk out of that store?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, your bill will depend on how many groceries you get, how many bags you use. I can't answer how what you pay for your groceries.
Right I know now. Some people like the double bag, so I guess they'd be paying 10 cents if they really wanted to do that. Anything further, Representative Anderson?
No.
All right. Representative Bowe.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. First of all, well, a statement perhaps. Pet owners everywhere are disappointed because a lot of pet owners rely on plastic bags for cleaning up after their dog when they walk them in the neighborhood or cleaning the cat box at home and making sure that the paper bag doesn't burst and drop that material all over the living room floor. So this will make that cost more. But the question then, unrelated to that discussion, but are the fees then that are collected by the store considered to be income and you know, recorded as such and taxable as such?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to look into that for you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson's questions started to get the gears moving again. So I've heard Representative Mann mention 5 cents, and then I've also heard you mentioned a dollar. First, is there a cap as to how much a retailer might charge for a plastic bag?
Representative Mann.
Also, thank you. I'm just going to add to that, Madam Chair. I'm also curious if the representative has done any kind of research to see how many plastic bags go through an average grocery store in a day and how much we're talking about in terms of volume.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, so we did not put a cap on how much you can charge. We put a base of 5 cents, and we left that open specifically because we want retailers and small businesses to have the freedom to charge what they think is appropriate. As far as how many bags per store, that varies greatly on the size of the store. Again, we know that as a country, it's about 100 billion bags per year. We also know that several countries have banned bags entirely. Or have imposed a small fee. And in the countries that have imposed a small fee, like Ireland, South Africa, UK, we've seen decrease in use of bags up to 90%. That's 90% less plastic bags in our environment. We've also seen studies done in Washington or Chicago that have decreased, 5 cent fee has decreased the use of plastic bags by over 50%. So again, it's not, In every place that this has been enacted, the people are ready for it. To the tune of 50% less usage of plastic bags and 50% less plastic in our environment. So.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. There's a lot of giggling about the idea of the cost of groceries going up. The bottom line, if grocery stores around the state increase the cost of packaging, that causes my household or any other household who may not have had the foresight to have all of the cloth bags ready before we go to the grocery store, or maybe this just isn't for them. Your costs overall go up, and Representative Anderson is making that point only to be responded to by giggling. That affects families around the entire state. And maybe even to Representative Lewick's point, it affects businesses that may not get the memo and may make a mistake, and it could cost them $1,000 a day because they just missed the fact that this bill, if it were to become law, please God, I hope not, but if it did, they could wind up with thousands of dollars of fine while the other side of the table giggles. This is serious, and it hurts businesses and it hurts individuals in a significant way.
And I'll just remind members that the A1 amendment did the fee won't be charged to folks who qualify based on income. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, the cost of packaging does not go up. It stays exactly the same. especially for the retailer. And also, I would be happy to entertain any amendments to decrease that fine or to even let the first and second violation go unfined completely. I have no problem with that.
Representative Green, we've got quite the list going. I'll remind members we have two more bills on the calendar. We do have testifiers from out of town for one of those bills. So, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Heinzman. You made one of my points as far as thinking it's funny that your cost is going to go up. Now, you've deleted some people here, and I'm not sure how that's going to work. Maybe you could inform me as to do people have to go in and then say, hey, I fit into these programs here, so you can't charge me? And also, what do you do with the people who are on Social Security that aren't on another program but are, you know, we hear it all the time. They're trying to make the decision, do they buy groceries today or do they pick up their prescriptions? Or how come they're not included?
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, what was the first part of your question?
Representative Green.
Let's just go with the why aren't the people on Social Security and how do you know how much money a person has, basically?
Okay. Representative Mann.
Yeah, so most people who are on WIC or TANF or SNAP have some kind of identification or card with them that they use to pay, so that would be easily delineated at the checkout. As far as the Social Security population, that was just not something that we thought of, honestly, but that's a really great point, and I would absolutely entertain adding them to the list as well.
All right. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mann, for bringing this bill forward. This is an issue I've been interested in a while, and it's a conversation that's bubbling at the local level in Northfield in my district. Speaking of the recyclability of these single-use plastic bags was brought up earlier in some conversations I've had with those who are responsible for this recycling and sorting recyclables. The plastic bags get caught up in the machinery and cause a significant loss of efficiency and lots of problems for those who are recycling. So they see them as a nuisance. So I think anything we can be doing to reduce the usage of single-use plastic bags is extremely important. And also want to speak to the cost issue just briefly. If you're shopping, have five plastic bags, you know, it's 25 cents. So I think this is a reasonable proposal. And if it can change our use, I think that's extremely helpful.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lippert brought up the point I wanted to make, and that was really about the recycling of plastic bags and pitching them in with our single sort isn't how they should be handled, and so oftentimes they don't get recycled. And I also wanted to say that because we have all this single-use plastic, we are coming up with microplastics in our lakes and streams and waterways, and so this is the use of plastics is a big issue, and so thank you for bringing the bill forward. And in regards to any laughing or snickering, it had nothing to do with the cost of groceries. It had to do with the exchange that was happening between the representatives regarding clarification. And so I do apologize if there was any disrespect taken. It was certainly not intended. I appreciate the intent behind the bill, and I appreciate the support you have.
Representative
Purcell.
Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, I support the bill, and thank you for bringing it, Representative Mann. And just in regard to the cost of groceries that we pay as we walk out of pay our bill at the grocery store, and I don't know what to say about Bemidji, but we've got a grocery store up there that take a nickel or dime off your bill right off it if you bring your own bag in there instead of having them bag it up in plastic. And they've been doing this for a couple of years. I mean, this is, I don't know if we're special people up there, maybe, but we've got stores that are doing this stuff, and they're doing it for the right reasons, that as we just heard, plastic's all over our environment. If it doesn't bring a tear to your eye when you see a plastic bag up in a pine tree hanging on a branch, come on. I mean, this is ridiculous what's going on with plastic in our environment. Thank you.
You can save a couple cents at Caribou, too, if you bring your your coffee mug. So, Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heinzman is correct. This is serious. And it's a serious reduction in cost to taxpayers who are managing all this waste. So if you listen carefully to Representative Mann, who talked about the amount of waste reduction, then that's a reduction in cost to taxpayers. So I'm actually very grateful that you called for a roll call.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mann, every time I go to my local grocery store, they ask me paper or plastic. And oftentimes I'll take paper simply because our logging industry relies on making paper. But my question is what prevents the store from charging for the bags now?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, nothing. And in fact, a lot of stores do already charge for bags.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then why do we need this bill?
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, because we want stores to be charging for bags. We want to change our behavior. We want to use less plastics. We want to decrease pollution in the environment.
All right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mann, for bringing this bill to us. There is a cost to plastic. It's a cost that's unseen. Representative Purcell is right. I think if we walked outside right now, we'll see plastic bags blowing in the wind. There'll probably be some hung up on the trees or in the shrubs outside of this building. So putting a cost to help reduce them versus trying to recover them through recycling, which has not worked. Voluntary. I've been putting bags in the fronts of grocery stores where they've had the receptacles. But a lot of that went to China, and it's not going there anymore. Recycling is not going to save us. Recycling is not going to save us. We have to reduce the use of plastic. I just had someone say that a grocery store may spend $150,000 to $200,000 on bags per year. If we can reduce that, that's a cost savings for the grocery store. And then if there's a charge, it helps pay for the cost of those plastic bags where maybe they don't slip away. Maybe they don't blow in the wind. Maybe they don't end up in our lakes. Maybe they don't end up in turtles. Maybe they don't end up wrapped around eagles. Then I think we've done what we should be doing, which is trying to protect all of us. We are part of this environment. I haven't found anybody yet who wants to be drinking and eating plastic. But I think folks may have seen a new species was found, I think, in the Marianas Trench. What's inside of it? Plastic. This is a small step that is not punitive. It provides for choice and shows the true cost. If there's change, I think this bill is going to judiciary or somewhere where the penalty can be modified if needed to make it more incentive-based. But I think it's time. So I would support the bill, and I'm glad there's a roll call.
Right. I will remind members, this is the motion is that this would move on to commerce. Thank you all for the discussion. Representative Mann, any quick closing comments, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we know this is an effective way to reduce plastic waste. We've seen it work everywhere it's been implemented. It decreases our global warming potential, our freshwater aquatic ecotoxicity, our marine aquatic toxicity, and terrestrial ecotoxicity. I appreciate your support.
All right, a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Purcell?
Aye.
Becker Finn?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Acom?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Bowe?
No.
Claflin?
Yes.
Fabian?
No.
Gomez?
Yes.
Green?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Heinzman?
No.
Lippert?
Yes.
Lislegaard?
No.
Wagenius?
Yes.
With 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion passes. So it would be House File 3847 be referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And you're not going anywhere. Next up on the agenda is House File 3338. Also, a Representative Mann bill. And members, we do have this room until 11:30. We do not have a room for this evening. So if we want to get to both bills, let's all stay as focused as possible. I will move House File 3338 be referred to the Committee on Commerce. I see that there is an author's amendment. I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mann, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3338 is a very simple bill that simply states that when you go out to eat, a pile of straws will no longer be dropped on your table. If you want a straw, you just have to ask for one. The point of this bill, again, same thing as the last bill, is to give us a second of pause before we go on using single-use plastics so that we can start to change our behaviors and use less single-use plastics, which, again, we know end up polluting our environment. Environmentalists and behavioral scientists have noted that letting go of a single piece of plastic could be the first step to a much-needed larger behavioral change. To clarify, this bill is not a ban on straws. The amendment actually fixes a problem that you felt was important in the last bill, is that it decreases the violation fees and removes the fine for the first violation.
Thank you, Representative Mann. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion. We just had a very spirited debate on single-use plastics. So again, let's try to stay focused. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Representative Mann has been able to find a source for paper straws or otherwise that does not contain PFAS.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have not done that research because I did not ban plastic straws in this bill, Representative.
Representative Heinzman.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I haven't. I did do some research, and it may be that this bill is a little bit of ahead of the actual product that is available. And as this committee knows, and many of those watching at home know, PFAS is a huge problem, and our recycled straws wind up in compost facilities. And compost facilities are struggling greatly as we find PFAS in leachate and in solids. And one of the primary upstream sources are products like this.
I'll remind members, if you go to line 1.15, this bill doesn't ban the use of plastic straws. It's just saying that an establishment must not provide or sell a single-use plastic straw unless requested by the person. Representative Mann, if you have any further comment to that.
No, that is correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who specifically would enforce this?
Representative Mann, and I believe this bill is on its way to Commerce. So, okay. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Same thing with the other bill. As far as I know, it would be under the AG's office jurisdiction.
Representative Lewick.
Well, at least out where I live, the folks that are serving beverages have a food and beverage license, and that's in at least one county, that's a delegated authority, and they issue the license. Next door, the state of Minnesota, through the Department of Health, issues the license. So are we going to somehow guess as to whether the Attorney General is going to be the straw police or whether you're going to put this mandate on another department or down at the county level? I mean, you know, you're talking about food and beverage service. That's literally what that license allows them to do, and they are under regulation. So, again, roll call vote, please. I'm not going to beat up all the small establishments out in rural Minnesota where I live with something like this, or take a chance that this is going to be another brutal mandate on counties, particularly the ones that are delegated, that are out there doing a good job doing food and beverage licensing.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually think that you're right, Representative. I do think that provisions would be enforced by MDH, now that I think of it. But also, again, all the bill is saying is that if you want a straw, you ask for one. That's it.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there someone here from the Attorney General's Office or MDH to testify? I've got some questions.
I don't think that there is. I will remind folks we are in the Environment Policy Committee. I know this bill has some other stops ahead of it. Representative Mann, any comment to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, we have probably at least two, if not three, other committees to go through where that stuff will be handled specifically.
Thank you.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick statement. I appreciate the fact that this is voluntary. It's not an outright ban. At least, you know, it's not providing the straw up front, and it can be requested. So I appreciate the leniency and the flexibility in that area.
All right. Anyone, I'm not sure if I asked yet, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, Representative Green.
I just wanted to clarify that this bill does just a little bit more than only requires people to ask for a straw. It imposes a pretty stiff penalty if out of sheer repetition, a server drops a straw on a table, somebody could say, I didn't ask for that straw, and I'm turning you in. That's what this bill does.
All right, a roll call having been requested, I would renew my motion that House File 3338 as amended be referred to the Committee on Commerce. We'll go ahead with the roll call.
Purcell.
Aye.
Becker Finn.
Yes.
Lewick.
No.
Akam.
Yes.
Anderson.
No.
Bowe.
No.
Claflin.
Yes.
Fabian.
No.
Gomez.
Yes.
Green.
No.
Hansen.
Yes.
Heintzman. Lippert.
Yes.
Lislegaard.
No.
Wiginius.
Yes. All right. With 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right. Our last bill on the agenda again. We do have the room for another 16 minutes, so hopefully that is sufficient. It is House File 848, and I will move that it be laid over for possible inclusion. I do have an amendment that is labeled A1. I did speak briefly with the author about this amendment. I don't think it undermines what he's attempting to do. So the A1 amendment would just clarify that if we have, if there are special hunts going on in a jurisdiction, for instance, in my case, I had a constituent who works for Three Rivers Park District, that they would still be able to limit the use of what type of firearms are used if they're in a more populated area or just choose to run their special hunt that way. All those, any further discussion to the A1 amendment? Representative Swidzinski.
Yes, Madam Chair. I view that as a friendly amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The amendment passes. Representative Swidzinski, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 848 is a pretty straightforward bill. It simply eliminates the shotgun zone for taking deer in Minnesota. This bill eliminates the shotgun zone during the regular firearm season. An exception is made, obviously, with the amendment and also, I think, with other law potentially for allowing local units of government to have certain jurisdictions in this particular area. But this bill really is before you due to the strong shift in technology with the advancement in Sabot slugs coupled with a major shift to rifle caliber pistols in all calibers. This bill is simply adding a few inches of barrel to the tools deer hunters use to hunt. And with that, I have folks with the Minnesota Deer Hunters here to speak on behalf of the bill and appreciate your time.
Right. And Mr. Engwall, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Craig Engwall, I'm the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association Executive Director here on behalf of our 20,000 members and 60 chapters. Through our grassroots process, our chapters can bring forward resolutions, and our Des Moines Valley chapter in Windham brought forward a resolution that mirrors this legislation. Our first consideration looking at things is safety, and so we look to DNR enforcement and DNR for those issues. They're the experts, we aren't, and since they're not opposing this, then we look beyond that question to why should we do this. And one of the things, there are a number of matters in the the representative has brought those forward, but we look at the ease of use for young people. Many smaller caliber rifles are easier to use than a shotgun with slug with more kick, etc. We're concerned about recruitment, and the more people can use things safely, the better we feel and the better recruiting opportunity there is. We also are, just like DNR, we're looking for simplifications of rules statewide. This bill would do that. And because time is limited, I won't go into the other issues unless asked. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Engwall. I do see Colonel Smith from the DNR is here. You don't necessarily have to testify. You know, he said that the DNR is okay with this. He's giving the thumbs up for the record. Colonel Smith from the DNR is giving the thumbs up to this bill. Is there anyone else from the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, members, any discussion to the bill? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zinski, I understand in the farmland zone, you know, where there may be wide open horizon where you can see your target, I can see the support there. I am concerned about the hills. I'm concerned about the Karst region, and I'm concerned about the hills and the topography of the southeast with rifle. And just for the record, I used rifle during one of the special hunts for CWD. I think that, you know, I understand the safety that DNR is okay with this. I think you might find some landowner concern in the southeast, particularly where the topography is such that that rifle shot may not be able to back it up, depending on how it is. So I'm cautious about the southeast zone. I know this is being laid over, but I understand the technology's changed. I understand, you know, what's happening out there. I understand about the rifle or the pistols, but I have concern about just what stops the bullet in the southeast.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, obviously, I think when you're out in the field and on a hunt, you know, the biggest thing you're always thinking about is safety. That you only want to bring something home, but you also want to get home. And I think, you know, this doesn't stop landowners, particularly, you know, if they're allowing folks to hunt their land. I think they have the ability to say, you know, to allow technology. I mean, it's their land. If they want to have people hunt their land with shotgun, they can dictate that. But also, I know there's been some special hunts done when they had some major drawdowns in the population in southeast Minnesota, where they had a vast takedown of animals, and they allowed rifles to be used during those hunts for the general public, not just for sharpshooters. So there is some history in the southeast, and I think looking at the votes that the deer hunters, that was a particular area that showed an extra strong preference for this particular legislation.
Representative Anderson.
I had a question, but I can talk to the DNR offline. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, any further discussion to this bill? All right. Representative Swidzinski, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I certainly appreciate being included in any final bill moving forward. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File, well, I guess we're laying it over, so I will House File 3338 as our. That's not correct. House File 848, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Thank you.
All right, and thank you, members, for the discussion. And with that, we are adjourned.